While this episode's guest is not from Ohio, the story he tells in his book, Our Team, the epic story of four men in the World Series that changed baseball, most certainly is. Author Luke Eplin vividly brings back to life the frenetic Cleveland Indians season of 1948. Driven by the confluence of four unlikely personalities, the innovative and inexhaustible owner, Bill Veeck, the All-American pitching phenom, Bob Feller, a mercurial and aged Negro League fan favorite and superstar, Satchel Paige, and the first black player in the American League, Larry Doby. Together, they deliver Cleveland its one and only World Series championship while uprooting baseball norms and casting a new mold for MLB. It's my proud privilege to grant writer Luke Eplin honorary Ohio citizenship and welcome him to From Ohio. I started off by asking Luke to tell us about his recent trip back to Cleveland to promote the paperback release of Our Team.
Yeah, I did a couple of events. I spoke to the City Club of Cleveland, interviewed by the head of the Cleveland Public Library, which is where I did a tremendous amount of the research for the book. And then I did an event at the Baseball Heritage Museum, which, as you know, is where the old League Park was, where the Cleveland Indians played until 1946, also where the Cleveland Buckeyes played. And so a lot of my book's history took place at that very site. So it was really great to be able to speak there.
Luke, you're not from Ohio. You're from Illinois?
Yeah, I'm from a small town in Illinois. I grew up a big St. Louis Cardinals fan, and my knowledge of the Cleveland Indians before this book was pretty negligible.
Well, how did you get interested in this story about these four guys, which we'll talk about a little bit, and that season of 1948?
My grandfather was a big fan of the St. Louis Browns, and St. Louis used to have two baseball teams until the mid-50s. The St. Louis Cardinals were usually pretty good, and the St. Louis Browns were almost always terrible. My grandfather was odd in that he liked the Browns. So I grew up knowing more about the Browns than people of my age did. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think anybody who knows anything about the Browns knows is that Bill Veeck was the last owner of the team. He did a whole bunch of things to try to excite fans of the team, including bringing a little person to the plate, having fans manage from the grandstands, giving away wild promotional giveaways, fireworks, the whole nine yards that we now associate with Bill Veeck and his promotional apparatus. Mm-hmm. And so I was interested in writing about Veeck as a character. I think he's larger than life. He's sort of a perfect figure to center a nonfiction book around. And I wanted to do it on the Browns to honor my grandfather, but it was really only through researching Veeck in his previous tenure as the owner of the Cleveland Indians from 1946 to 1949, that I realized that what is the most significant thing about Bill Veeck is the way that he integrated the American League and how that is, at least outside of Cleveland, not as well known. So that is how I shifted focus to the Cleveland Indians.
You know, today's the day Jackie Robinson crossed the color barrier, and 75 years ago. And I know you wrote an article in the Washington Post. It was an editorial about honoring Larry Doby. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I think that these celebrations that we do annually on what is now known as Jackie Robinson Day, which is April 15th, whenever Jackie Robinson broke into the National League on the Brooklyn Dodgers, are very worthwhile and a good thing that Major League Baseball has done. However, by only centering the story of integration on Jackie Robinson and then Branch Rickey, the president of
who's from Ohio, I might add, Branch Rickey.
Yes, an Ohio native. It really tends to have people believe that that is the central and perhaps lone story of integration. And then once Jackie Robinson sort of opened the doors, the people were able to come in and have a sort of easier time with it. But that's just not how it was. There were concurrent stories that were happening alongside Robinson's entry, including Larry Doby, who came into the American League a mere 11 weeks later in July of 1947. And he had a vastly different experience than Jackie Robinson did. So by only telling the Jackie Robinson story, we tend to sort of erase these other narratives that were happening at the same time and that had sort of different aspects to them. So I think that by honoring Larry Doby every year on July 5th, Major League Baseball could both expand our knowledge of the way that integration happened in the game and give room to talk about other pioneers that came in Jackie Robinson's wake.
Yeah, sure. You know, let's talk a little bit about Larry Doby and, you know, his existence in Cleveland. It was sort of a harsh entry for him, very lonely, very isolating. And I wanted you to tell me a little bit about what you found out about what his home life was like in Cleveland at that time. And, you know, of course, what his relationship was with the other players on the team. But I'm kind of wondering, like, how did he feel about being in Cleveland? Did he have friends? You mentioned in the book about a place mm-hmm. he used to go to in Cleveland Heights on, was it Parmalee Avenue, something like that. There was a friend mm-hmm. that was over there. So where did he live? What did he do? And how did he feel while he was in Cleveland?
Well, first of all, Larry Doby only found out that he was going to be going to Cleveland days before it actually happened. He did not have a transition period like Jackie Robinson did, where Robinson spent a year in the minor leagues before going up to Brooklyn, which gave him sort of an acclimation or a transition period where he could sort of wrap his mind around integration and take care of logistics, just right. where he's going to live and all these sorts of things. Larry Doby was living in New Jersey, playing on the Newark Eagles and the Negro Leagues. He finds out he is being signed by the Cleveland Indians, plays one last game for the Newark Eagles, boards a train to Chicago where the Indians were playing the White Sox. And then the very next day, on July 5th, 1947, he's in uniform on the Indians. It's a real shock to his system. He's so nervous when he comes to the plate that day that he can't stop his teeth from chattering.
Oh my!
So as you can imagine, he's not able to really take care of logistical things about where he's going to live in Cleveland. So for the first few weeks that he's in Cleveland in 1947, he stays at a place called the Majestic Hotel, which is a hotel that hosted a lot of sort of black celebrities and dignitaries at the time. It was a real gathering place for African Americans in Cleveland in the 1940s and beyond. And he's given a huge welcome there by other sort of black celebrities in Cleveland, such as Marion Motley and other Jesse Owens, other sorts of big athletes at the time. Luckily, Larry Doby was in the Navy before he came onto the Indians, and he befriended a player there named Arthur Grant, who was an old Negro League player from the Cleveland Buckeyes, who had since retired when he came back from the war and was a sanitation worker in Cleveland. So Larry Doby moves into the second floor of Grant's three-story house on Parmalee Avenue. And that really becomes another sort of node of African-American gathering in the city. I was able to talk to Arthur Grant's daughters, and they talked about how Jesse Owens, Harrison Dillard, when Jackie Robinson passed through town, they would all come to Arthur Grant's house and sort of hold court there in his living room.
Wow.
And so Doby moves he and his wife into the second floor of that place, and it's an interesting neighborhood. It's kind of mixed among white and black residents. His daughters, Arthur Grant's daughters, said that it was really a place for the sort of African American elites to live. There were doctors, lawyers, teachers, middle class professionals, people like that. And Larry Doby becomes kind of the hero of that neighborhood. Anywhere he goes, people are coming up to him and talking about how significant what he is doing for the city is. And so he really finds a sort of comfortable home life in that area among friends. It's a real zone of safety for him in Cleveland.
You know, Luke, you paint such a vivid, detailed, I just loved reading the book. And, you know, I felt like I was walking around on the shoulders of these guys, you know, during this frenetic season of 1948. And I'm just wondering, A, how long did it take you to research the book? How did you do the research and find out all of these incredible details? Because, like I said, I felt I was rocking right alongside these guys.
Yeah, this story happened roughly 75 years ago. So most of the principal figures in this book have since passed away, and I was not able to talk to them. So I really did have to rely on interviews that they had done at various times in their lives, newspaper accounts, magazines, and whatnot. I went to the Cleveland Library, and at the time, Cleveland had four newspapers: the Plain Dealer, the Cleveland Press, the Cleveland News, and the Call and Post, which was the African American newspaper. I read every single issue from 1946 to 1949, sort of cover to cover, which took a long time and a lot of time in the.
How long
the
did it take you to research the book?
It took about 2 years, and you know, some of it was a little bit easier than others. I mean,
what was the most difficult part?
Well, out of the four main characters, there's Bill Veeck, Bob Feller, Satchel Paige, Larry Doby. Veeck, Paige, and Feller all use their own life stories as almost like a form of currency. They would tell them over and over and over again. These were all men, all three of them had written more than one autobiography in their lifetime. And they were very open with interviewers about all these aspects of their lives. The most difficult part of the book was Larry Doby. He was a very introverted person. He did not like opening up to interviewers. I think I say in the book that he treats interviews the way that like we would treat sitting down into a dentist chair. Yeah. He just wanted to get them over with. Yeah. And so it was very difficult to sort of find interviews where Doby is comfortable enough to open up about his experiences. And so it took a lot of digging to get to the heart of that individual and to make sure that I rendered him in enough nuance to be able to pass him off with the way that he deserves. He never wrote his autobiography in his lifetime, which is incredible. I mean, here is a monumental figure in American sports, and he was quite enigmatic and difficult to penetrate.
You know, he had a very somewhat unusual relationship with Satchel Paige when he joined the team, and kind of wondering if you could talk a little bit about the dynamic between the two of them. And, you know, my dad, who was about 11 years old when this series happened, was telling me these Satchel Paige stories. He said he used to sit in the dugout on a rocking chair before he would go out to pitch.
Satchel Paige was a truly larger-than-life figure. He was somebody who came from the Deep South. He came of age during the Great Depression in the Negro Leagues, whenever black baseball was really kind of in a state of collapse. A lot of teams and entire leagues were going under because of the lack of funds. And he kind of had to turn himself into a one-man franchise. And he was so good at sort of creating a persona that could excite crowds and that could really just draw people to the stadium every time he pitched. And a lot of the sort of ways he did it was by sort of his persona was reminiscent of an actor by the name of a character by the name of Stephen Fetchett, where you had somebody who walked really slow with a blank expression across his face, kind of, you know, almost like a comic persona. And then he would get on the mound and sort of do these wild windmill windups and things like that, and then throw a pitch that was faster than anything this side of Bob Feller. It was this sort of combination of this sort of slow, almost like comic shuffle to the mound, and then this incredible fast mastery of his craft that really just drove fans wild. And, you know, he would tell humorous stories. He would do, as you said, sit in sort of a rocking chair in the bullpen because nobody quite knew how old he was.
Luke, I have to ask you, why is it so undeterminable how old he was? Did Satchel know how old he was?
I think he did. He was born in 1906. We now know this with some degree of certainty. It just seemed like he'd been around forever by that point. He was 42 by the time the Cleveland Indians signed him.
Wow.
But since he'd been around forever and seemed to pitch constantly in every part of the country and beyond, people would tell us tales of having seen him in 1910 or 19 whatever. And of course, he would have been 4 or 5 years old at this time. And so it was all sort of the part of the mythology that had sprung up around him, which Satchel Paige, you know, readily cultivated, sort of understanding that that sort of mythology was going to help sort of keep fan interest high. So Paige played along with these games about how old he was, you know, always saying, like, if someone said, are you 50? And he'd said, well, maybe. You know, he would always just kind of be very indeterminate about everything. Mm-hmm. Now, whenever you get to Larry Doby, this is a very different generation. Doby is 17 years younger than Satchel Paige. He grew up more in this sort of idea that for the integration process to occur, Black players needed to be sort of dignified and sort of, you know, present the best sides of themselves at all time. And he looked at Satchel Paige and the sort of like persona that he cultivated, the way that he used humor to diffuse sort of tricky situations, things like this, and really just kind of saw something that he was trying to fight against. And so he was constantly trying to tell Satchel Paige, like, to show up to the ballpark on time, not to, you know, use your sort of humor in certain situations, to just act dignified overall. And Satchel Paige was somebody who, you know, was probably the most famous baseball player on the planet if you looked at both sort of white and black fans. And he's sort of wondering why this younger player is scolding him so much. And so they simply had generational differences and sort of philosophical differences that resulted from that, that prevented them from ever seeing eye to eye.
You know, I tell us about that night in Cleveland where there was a charity game and there were four black players playing. It was the Dodgers against the Cleveland Indians. And I believe you say in the book, at least 40% of the fans that turned out that night were black.
Yeah, one of the sort of Bill Veeck's concerns about signing black players was, would it affect sort of white fans that were not interested in integration or that would not supportive of integration? And he sort of reasoned that for every white fan that he lost by signing players like Larry Doby and Satchel Paige, he would gain a black fan. And I think that is most exemplified by that game where the Indians are playing an exhibition game. This had no bearing on the standings for the Indians versus the Dodgers. And that was the first game that brought together all four African-Americans in Major League Baseball, and Jackie Robinson, Roy Campanella on the Dodgers, Paige and Doby on the Indians. And it was estimated that sort of one out of every six black residents in Cleveland was at the game. Wow. And so even though, again, this had no bearing there, it was something like 65,000 people showed up just to see this.
Wow.
And it's, you know, Veeck's concerns about attendance were turned out to be false. I mean, not only did white fans continue to show up to support an integrated team, the Indians shattered every attendance record basically in Major League Baseball in 1948. I mean, the sort of surge of black fans that came, that got added on to the white fans that normally came, produced almost like a frenzy across the city.
Yeah. Luke, what was it about Cleveland that sort of allowed for this incredible season to happen? You know, we talk about the four individuals, but if we can't add a fifth personality to it, let's talk about the city itself. That what was it about Cleveland that lent itself to making this epic story happen?
There's so much about Cleveland that made this epic story happen. Cleveland was seeing runaway growth for about 50 years leading up to the Great Depression. Its industrial base grew extremely rapidly until then. Once you get to the Great Depression, suddenly you had just a shutdown of industry in the city. Really kind of fell on a bit of hard times. It lost population for the first time. But then you have World War II, which really revived this industrial base and sort of redefined it in some ways. So you have sort of Cleveland sort of hitting another spurt after the Great Depression is over, but sort of feeling kind of like down on its luck for maybe 10 years from, like, maybe, I don't know, 1933 to 1943 through 45 or so. And they were just ready to let go. The city was feeling like it had gone through these sorts of terrible times. It had come out on the other end. It had more population than it ever had, close to a million people. It had sort of an integrated city and integrated workforce that was in some ways more advanced than other cities at the time. They were creating sort of councils in city government where they could examine issues such as workplace discrimination, things like this. So you had a city that was inching toward integration in a way that other big cities weren't. And you just had sort of people feeling like they'd come through the worst 12 years that they could ever imagine. And now they wanted to celebrate, but they didn't know how. And so baseball, and Bill Veeck in particular, what he sort of did to excite these fans, gave them that that sort of trigger to let loose these emotions that they bottled up for so long, so that whenever you do have 1948 come around and the Cleveland Indians are suddenly in this extremely exciting pennant race, they were just turning out and supporting the Indians, using the Indians almost as a means of channeling that energy that they hadn't been able to release during the sort of 12 years prior.
You know, my uncle told me a story once where around that time he was in Cleveland. I think he was living up there at the time, and he and his friends were out walking along one day, and they, I guess they were hitchhiking, and believe it or not, Bob Feller picked him up in the car and gave him a ride. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about Bob Feller. And also, in Cleveland, I understand he lived in this kind of a sprawling house or estate in Gates Mills, and he was quite an entrepreneurial individual. But the one thing that I was wondering about is, you know, he didn't have a very high regard for the Negro players in terms of them actually being major league players, but simultaneously, he tapped into their talents for all of his barnstorming tours.
He's a really complex individual. First of all, I think that you can't talk about Bob Feller without talking about his origin story, because I think it still is the greatest origin story ever for an American athlete. He's come from a small town. He comes from a farm in sort of the middle of Iowa. He evinces this extraordinary talent from an early age, so much so that his dad recognizes it and clears off a part of their pasture and builds him this baseball diamond right there on the farm.
It's like Field of Dreams, basically.
Yeah, it's essentially the Field of Dreams. And so Feller sort of plays on this field from a very early age, like 12 or so, through his high school years against many years his senior, and just kind of dominates them. Through sort of happenstance, he makes it onto the Indians at age 17 when he's still a high school junior. And in his very first start ever in Major League Baseball, he ties the American League record for strikeouts. Four starts later, he ties the Major League record for strikeouts. It is such a sort of jaw-dropping thing that he becomes essentially like the poster boy for American youth. He makes it on the cover of Time magazine, and when he's a senior in high school, and when he graduates from high school, NBC Radio carries the graduation ceremony live from coast to coast. That is how popular he is. And so he kind of invests in this persona of this all-American boy who gets there through hard work, self-determination, durable family bonds, the sort of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps values that sort of lead to the so-called American dream. And I think it kind of affected the way that he saw black players. If you sort of look at the way he talks about black players, he always says, when people would ask him before integration if black players could play in the major leagues, he says, no, they're, you know, some of them are pretty fast, some of them hit pretty hard, some of them can throw pretty well, but they don't sort of combine the qualities that you need for an American, for a major leaguer. And I think what he's basically saying is that if they did, they'd be there already, like I did. He has no problem sharing the field with them, which he does on these barnstorming tours, which is whenever a bunch of major leaguers would get together after the season ended, do these sort of exhibition games in cities across the country that didn't get to see Major League Baseball. And they could do things there that they can't do in a major league game, most notably play against teams of all black players. And so Feller had no problem not only playing against black players, but exposing himself to defeat. He got defeated quite a bit in these barnstorming games, especially against Satchel Paige, who he sort of teamed up against in order to sort of, you know, draw more fans and thus make more money on these tours. So he used these sort of black players as a means of sort of enriching himself and sort of, you know, getting his name out there and things like that. But he had this sort of mythology of that, you know, you have to pull yourself up by your own sort of good. And it sort of prevented him from seeing the structural barriers that made it so that African American players couldn't have the same narrative that he had.
What was it about that season, if you had to kind of boil it down to one or two things, that those four guys did with that team that's still alive today in Major League Baseball? In other words, what did they change, or what was the new mold that they gave baseball?
That's a tough question. I think that you'd have to sort of look at it in different ways. I think that Bill Veeck, his influence is so well felt today that anytime you go to a sporting event, it doesn't matter what it is. It could be hockey, could be basketball, could be whatever. Mm-hmm. You're going to feel the influence of Dulvec. You're going to see t-shirt cannons. You're going to see giveaways. You're going to see all of these sorts of things that stadiums do in between the play on the field to entertain fans. And that's all sort of invented by Bill Veeck, who is the sort of grandfather of the modern stadium experience. He believed that sort of entertainment could coexist with a really hard-fought competitive game. And so anytime you go to any sort of sporting event, you're going to see the influence of the 1948 Indians through Bill Veeck. But more importantly, I think that what Bill Veeck did on that team was he realized that the Cleveland Indians had always been in sort of fourth, fifth, sixth place. They could never sort of get past the sort of powerhouses of the Yankees and the Red Sox and the Tigers. And so he was going to beat them in ways that they refused to do. Namely, he was going to integrate the team and take the best sort of talent from there and then use integration as a means of finally getting past his rivals. And so Veeck had such success in doing this. A year after he integrates the team, the Indians win the World Series, that it does, even though kind of in a, you know, in a slow motion way, kind of sets into motion this idea that, you know, integration could not only sort of give you plaudits for showing how sort of progressive and tolerant you are, but could actually deliver your team from a second division start to the pennant.
Wow, yeah.
And so, yeah, you see teams like the Giants and others using this model that Bill Veeck provides for these owners. And so I think that integration, you know, it happens in various sort of fits and starts. People thought that Jackie Robinson was a really exceptional person because he always exceeded no matter what he did, whether it was basketball, track, football, something like that. Larry Doby showed that you can have a player come into Major League Baseball, totally flop his first year, and then if you stick with him, work with him, sort of, you know, give him the support that he needs, he could become that player that really takes your team to the next level. And so it really showed that unlike what Bob Feller said, where these players don't have what it takes, that maybe they don't at first, but if you stick with them, they can become the player that has what it takes.
Yeah. Well, after writing this book, are you still a Cardinals fan?
The Cardinals are my National League team, and the Guardians are now my American League team.
Okay.
I really enjoyed – I mean, they're very different fan bases. The Cardinals have won many, many championships, many World Series, and we always are sort of winning games whenever we shouldn't. We have a very charmed streak. Mm-hmm. And the Indians are the opposite. The Indians are, you know, losing games they should win. They're having sort of just horrible things happen to them. So the fan base is always kind of expecting the worst while we're expecting the best. And so that was a mindset that I had to bring myself into to learn what it was like to be a Cleveland baseball fan.
Yeah. All right. Luke, thank you so much for taking time to be with From Ohio.
Thank you so much.
That's the final out for this episode. We'll see you soon. In the meantime, if you like, give us a shout on Instagram at from_Ohio. OH!